Greetings and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I am your host, Lance White. My guest today is Andrew Philip Smith. Andrew was born in 1966 in Penarth, Wales, and attended the University College of Swansea. He's the author of The Gospel of Thomas, a new version based on the inner meaning, The Gospel of Philip, Annotated and Explained, The Lost Sayings of Jesus, Annotated and Explained, and Gnostic Writings of the Soul. Andrew has studied the Gospel of Thomas and the Fourth Way teachings since the late 1980s. He has given a number of presentations and readings of the Gospel of Thomas and other esoteric and poetical works. So let's welcome Andrew to the show now. Hi, Andrew. How are you? Are you there?
Hello.
Yes. Hi.
Very well, thank you.
It's always strange talking to somebody in another country because there's always some little snafu that has to be overcome. But I can hear you if you can hear me.
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, good.
Spring evening in Ireland here.
What time is it over there?
It's just after 8 p.m.
Oh, good. Early.
Yes. It's still light.
How did you first become interested in the hidden or esoteric aspects behind the writings that are out there in the public domain today?
Well, my first interest was through the Fourth Way of Gurdjieff. So when I was a teenager, I discovered the writings of Uspensky and of Gurdjieff himself, and that became my guiding light for the next 20 years or so. And in the Fourth Way, there's a tradition of interpreting the Christian scriptures esoterically.
Uh-huh.
There's an English writer who's a student of Uspensky, Morris Nicol, who wrote two books, The Mark and The New Man, that looked at the Gospels in the light of esoteric interpretation, that these weren't just stories about a person who existed in first century Galilee and Judea and had performed miracles and taught to the crowds, but the various elements, the story elements and the parables. In fact, the whole gospel as a whole was meant also had an inner meaning that was a spiritual meaning, and the different characters in these gospels represented different parts of ourselves. So I found that very interesting, and I was drawn to the study of the gospels and then the historical Jesus. I wanted to see Jesus as a spiritual teacher rather than as this God of the standard Christian religion.
Mm-hmm.
And it all went from there. I imagined at the beginning that I could just read a few books and get what I wanted from them. But the problem, as soon as I started reading, even quite reliable scholarly works about Jesus, I realized that you have to find out why they're saying what they're saying.
Uh-huh.
And you have to investigate their reasons, their reasoning. You have to go back to the original texts. You have to see them in a new light, not just take people's conventional interpretations. You really have to investigate these things yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that one of the values of the Nag Hammadi Library, that those texts were not discovered until the 1940s, I believe, so they weren't eliminated from the Bible that was created through the Council of Nicaea, is that correct?
Yes. It wasn't so much that they were specifically excluded, it's just they weren't, they didn't meet, they just weren't part of the canon, they weren't the books in the first place that the Orthodox Christians were using.
Mm-hmm.
And then when, like you said, you mentioned the Council of Nicaea, when Constantine adopted Christianity in his reign, and Christians who had previously been a persecuted minority and had been looked down upon by the, you know, the orthodoxy of the Roman Empire, they became their own orthodoxy. And as soon as they had power, they started to eliminate their rivals, and there was a fight for, you know, who had orthodoxy means the right point of view. So there was a fight to argue, to work out what the right point of view was.
Huh.
And all the Christian dogma began to be established at that time. But previous to that, I mean, there were lots of different Christian groups. And the Gnostics were, for the most part, were Christians, although there is a non-Christian kind of Gnosticism. And the Gnostics were the people who wrote the text that included the Nag Hammadi library. As you mentioned, that was discovered in 1945, right at the end of 1945, by an Egyptian peasant who was out searching for fertilizer. And he discovered a earthenware jar. And when he opened it, he found these 12 books, which are codices, they're manuscript books. Unfortunately, after that, the tale became a bit more complicated. It took a long time for these codices to make their way to scholars who could preserve them and translate them correctly. And apparently, some of the pages were even used as kindling for fire.
Oh, gee. Good night. Yeah. You know, what really disturbed me is when I heard about Constantine's compilation of the Orthodox material that they wanted to include in the Bible, they decided pretty much how it was going to be, how it was going to go down, that the really esoteric material, which is the kernel, the core, the essence of the teachings, was completely eliminated. Anything that didn't, that was a confusing or that sounded vague or anything like that was eliminated, and that's really where we could have just been light years ahead had we had access to those. Do you know what happened to those writings? Or did they go underground? Were they burned or destroyed? Do we know?
Well, no, we don't quite know. I mean, some of them were definitely destroyed. Some were, you know, all these things have to be copied by hand. They didn't have printing presses at the time.
Uh-huh.
And books wore out within a generation or two.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so people stopped copying them because they were told not to. I mean, up until that time, and even for a while after the time of Constantine, there was a great deal of variety in Christianity. And you know, they didn't quite have the concept of what belonged to the New Testament, what didn't belong. They just had writings that were scriptures that that they found important to themselves. The reason that the Nag Hammadi library was stored in this earthenware jar was probably that. There was a letter in the middle of the 4th century that we know had circulated in that area, a letter by Athanasius. And he told people to destroy false writings, you know, writings that didn't belong to developing canon. And it's quite probable that rather than destroy the writings, they just buried them in this earthenware jar. Perhaps some of the monks in the area were, you know, they wanted to do what their leaders told them to do, but they were didn't want to just destroy all these manuscripts that had been copied by hand and passed on from generation to generation, this great store of esoteric knowledge. And then when the canon of the New Testament was established, they added, it's not like the they're only the authentic books which are in the New Testament. There are several forgeries in the New Testament. The what are called the pastoral epistles, which are supposedly letters by St. Paul, the Apostle Paul, but they're actually forgeries, and they make Paul seem more orthodox than he really was, because there's a good amount of Gnostic thought in Paul's letters.
Interesting. Now, can you take us back to the time of the Gnostics and help us understand who these people were and why they were different from the mainstream and why they retreated into caves in the mountains? Didn't they leave? They fled for their lives, didn't they?
Well, that's probably the Essenes you're thinking of in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Gnostics
What were the predominant groups at the time of Christ, after Christ?
That's a good point, because the Gnostics weren't a kind of unified authoritarian movement. There were all sorts of different Gnostic groups. But we can divide them into two main groups. There were the Sethians, who looked to Seth, who was the third son of Adam and Eve. You know, there were Cain and Abel, the murderer and victim. But then there was Seth, who represented a new beginning for humanity. And on history, it's very difficult to reconstruct the origins of the Gnostics, because they just weren't interested in writing about it themselves. They were interested in myth and the interpretation of myth. And the... So the Sethians trace themselves back to Seth, and that they were the inheritors of the stream of humanity that had come through Seth, which wasn't the kind of humanity which consisted of the victim and the murderer, as in Abel and Cain. But this the seed of Seth, as they were called, they were the Gnostics. They were looking for the spirit. And the term Gnostic itself comes from the Greek word for to know, but to know in a direct way. Most languages have two words for knowing. One is just knowing a fact, you know, knowing what the square root of 9 is. The other way is knowing a person, and this is what gnosis is. Gnosis is the knowing God in a direct way, in the same way that you would know a person.
Now, doesn't Gnosis preclude having an intermediary, such as the various churches like the Catholics and so on, that state that one needs to have an intermediary to connect, to make that connection?
Because Gnosis is direct knowledge.
Okay.
There in the Gnostic writings, there are various... Redeemer figures or revealer figures or savior figures who come down. But they give knowledge and they teach mankind how they can reignite the spark of divinity within themselves, and so that they can know God directly and become part of the Pleroma, the world of fullness, the divine realm, where all these beings that have that still have a direct relationship to God. If you had to rely on your priest to tell you what was what, or revelations from 2,000 years ago to tell you what was what, you didn't have Gnosis. You didn't have that direct knowledge, direct connection with God.
There's also in the fourth way teachings. There's also the idea that one needs to find somebody who is connected. So in a sense, there's kind of an hierarchy there too, isn't there? Do you think that that's changing today? I mean, do you think that we're moving into an age where we can receive direct knowledge again, and how would we go about that?
Well, yes, I think things are definitely different today. We spoke about the idea of esotericism and in terms of hidden knowledge, and today knowledge isn't really very hidden. It's there for anybody who wants it, and the idea of the teacher-student relationship. But, I mean, it's very much open to abuse these days, you know, and with the, you know, of course, we have the whole cult system that, you know, envelops so many different facets of spiritual interest. But yes, that's a great strength of Gnosticism. I mean, there were Gnostic priests, there were even bishops, and that sort of thing. But it, you know, that didn't really mean the same thing that it does in very hierarchical religions, like the, well, you know, the Catholic faith is an obvious example. But I also think people should be as hard on fundamentalist Protestants as on the Catholics.
Yeah.
I think things are different now. I mean, it's not. I mean, of course, very few people can, you know, actually wake up or develop spiritually without other people. But that doesn't have to be a teacher-student contact. You know, if you want to wake up, if you're interested in spiritual development, then you want to meet other people who want the same, and some people are bound to be further along the path than you. But then when it becomes a sort of formal student-teacher relationship, it is very open to abuse and probably not all that in tune with the more democratic and egalitarian societies that we live in now.
From your studies and research with all of these different texts that most people are not familiar with, probably, or many are, but most aren't, how does the Christ that's mentioned in those texts differ from the one that's commonly perceived today?
Well, there are quite a few. I mean, there's quite a multiplicity of Christ. For example, in the Gospel of Thomas, in fact, the term Christ, you know, which is actually a title, not a name, is never used in the Gospel of Thomas. Jesus is used in the Gospel of Thomas.
Jesus, okay.
Yeah. And of all the writings in the Nicomedy Library, the Gospel of Thomas has the strongest claim to be a really early gospel. It may even, in its earliest form, be slightly earlier than the canonical gospels, than Matthew, Mark, and John. And in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus is a teacher. I mean, I've just had a go at a teacher-student relationship. But, there's an important part in the Gospel of Thomas where Jesus says to his disciples, "Tell me what I'm like. You know, like, what am I? What do you think I am?" And you know, Peter tells him one thing, Matthew tells him another thing, you know, you're a heavenly angel. And Thomas says, you know, I can't say what you are. And Jesus responds to Thomas. He says, because of what you said, my words will be like a fountain of water going to you and that will intoxicate you. So Thomas is the one who gets the right answer in this example. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus is a sort of straightforward spiritual teacher. And there's no mention of Christ. The only mention of the crucifixion is in a saying about taking up your cross and following me, which also existed independently in the first century, apart from Christianity. Obviously, Christ wasn't the only person who was crucified. He doesn't perform any miracles. He's not called Christ. He doesn't have a very divine role, really. But he's definitely spiritual, is Jesus. In the other Nag Hammadi writings, he's often a completely mythological figure. There's a very developed cosmology in the Gnostic writings, and one of the interesting aspects of that is that no two Gnostic texts describe it in the same way. The Gnostics were creative. Every Gnostic writer approached, you know, they looked at what the other Gnostics had written, and, you know, they knew the kind of myths that were circulating, but they had their own take on it in each case. So it could never become dogmatic. But in some of these, Christ is an aeon, which is like a divine being in the pleroma, the realm of fullness that is connected to God. And in some of them, he comes to earth as a redeemer or as a savior. But he's not the only figure. Seth also takes that role. Various other mythological beings in Gnosticism that do that. And then there's this whole category of Gnostic text in which the risen Christ teaches his disciples. After he's been crucified, he comes back as a spiritual being. And there's a concept called Docetism, which basically boils down to the fact that Jesus wasn't really on the earth as a physical being. Well, that wasn't the important part of him. He was a spiritual being, and some Gnostics even thought he didn't really have a genuine physical body because they were so repulsed by the emphasis on crucifixion and literal bodily resurrection. So in many of these Nicandy writings, he's the risen Christ, so he's a spiritual being, and he teaches the disciples, often the lesser-known disciples like Thomas or Mary Magdalene, and he teaches them about the whole mythology, which has resulted in the way that the world is now. And some parts of those writings are probably based on very early collections of sayings of Jesus. That's quite likely. But he wasn't the, God-Man who came to earth in the sort of, in the canonical Gospels. There are many takes on Jesus.
You just mentioned Mary, which is an important aspect of the story that has been relayed to us, and as I understand it, didn't Mary have a much more important role in the church, and the feminine aspect had been kind of surgically removed from the text that we have today and altered by men that didn't want any kind of divine feminine attributes?
Well, certainly, I wouldn't put it in quite that way, actually.
All right.
I think the feminine aspect is actually still there in the New Testament, but it was it's not that the material was cut out. It's the way of looking at it was changed, of course, in the figure of Mary, the mother of Jesus, since medieval times, there's been a very strong element in Catholicism. But of course, it's very limited. It's the feminine only, it's only function as mother. Whereas in the Gnostic writings, Mary Magdalene, she was a disciple. She wasn't there just as a wife or as a mother. She was a disciple in her own right. In fact, like in the Gospel of Mary, she is teaching Peter and Matthew and Thomas. And Peter gets quite upset about it. He doesn't like being told. She has the secret wisdom of Jesus, and she's telling Peter, and they start to get upset about it. In that case, it's Matthew who tells them, she actually talked to the Savior. She knows what she's saying to us, and we haven't heard this. Listen to what she's saying. If you go through the New Testament with the Chutkan, there are lots of important women in it. Paul mentioned several times that he was supported by wealthy Roman women. So I think it's actually, you know, I'm actually quite skeptical of the idea that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene.
Yes, I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you about that. Sir Lawrence Gardner has been talking about that on radio shows and such, that Jesus was married to Mary, and that she actually had an important role in establishing the church in England, and that they had children, and that brought up the whole idea of bloodlines and Merovingians and so on. What about all that stuff?
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, a lot of that has been shown to have been faked in terms of the modern Prieuré de Sion.
Right.
But, I mean, it is fascinating. I mean, you know, there's the legend that Joseph of Arimathea came to England in the first century and referred to in William Blake's poem, Jerusalem. And then, of course, there's a strong strain of medieval legend that Mary Magdalene went to the south of France. But I must say, if you go back early, I mean, it's the Gospel of Philip, actually, which is crucial in that idea. Because there is reference in the Gospel of Philip to Mary as Jesus' partner. And then there's the other reference to him kissing her on her... that's translator's lips, but in fact there's a lacuna, a gap in the text there. So we don't know where he's kissing her. Could have been anywhere. But the thing is that the Gospel of Philip isn't concerned with history. It's mostly symbolic and allegorical. But when you look, you know, everything is about the bridal chamber is a very strong theme, which is the marriage of the soul, which is our personal psychology, with the spirit, which is the divine aspect of ourselves.
Uh-huh.
So that's what it's aiming at. And probably the Jesus and Mary relationship in that has to do with the soul, the personal part of ourselves, marrying with the divine aspect of ourselves. I mean, and even in one Gnostic mythology, Jesus and Sophia, wisdom, their partners, which doesn't get mentioned so often because nobody really thinks that Jesus was actually married to the goddess Wisdom. So I may sound very skeptical about that.
Yeah.
But in the Nag Hammadi Library and in other Gnostic writings, Mary is disciple, you know, and often she knows things that the male disciples don't. I think that's a much stronger theme than her being the wife of Jesus, you know.
Right.
She's somebody in her own right in that way. She's not just Mrs. Jesus. She's a disciple no different from the male disciple, and even better informed than the male disciples.
Yes. I heard an interesting statement last night on a radio show. David Sirita was talking about quantum physics. Now, that's kind of, it may seem a little bit off base, but he mentioned about Christ, Jesus as saying that unless you make the outer as the inner and the inner as the outer and the dark as the light and the light as the dark and the male as the female and the female as the male, refers to how time is created in duality when it moves out of the oneness of everything. And that to re-ascend to oneness means going beyond the duality of what is apparent, which cancels each other out, and it's a literal movement into another dimension. Is there any kind of esoteric truth to our ability to move to a spiritual realm or another dimension that you can talk about?
Yes, I see that as an internal movement, you know, within reaching the highest parts within ourselves. And the passage you mentioned is from the Gospel of Thomas, actually. Again, I say that, you know, the with the female, neither male nor female. Personally, I see that as this uniting of the soul and the spirit. But beyond that, you know, you mentioned duality and unity. The Gnostics, in a way, they were dualists, because, like I said, there were these very strong myths in the background of Gnosticism. And the sort of standard Gnostic myth has you have unity at the top. You have God, the only God, and then he creates other beings. Often it's just a result of him seeing himself. I like this description that God saw himself like in a mirror or a pool of water. So we have the unity at the top there. And then we have all these spiritual beings that are still very connected with God. And then we have this fall, with Sophia, is one of the eons. And she falls from grace because she wanted to know something which wasn't to do with God. And there are various descriptions of it, but she gives birth to Yaldabaoth, who's the demiurge, who creates the world we're in.
Tell us about that.
Yes, well, Yaldabaoth, he also has other names like Saklas or Samael. He's the god of this world. He created this world, and he created matter. And also he had a hand in creating mankind. But the theme is always that he could never exclude the world of spirit from mankind. When Adam is created, sometimes Adam doesn't rise from the floor until something from the world of spirit, from the pleroma, comes down. So it's necessary to have that spiritual element for humanity to exist, but then that's an element that the demiurge can't control. You know, the false god can't control that element. So we all have the spiritual element within us, and it's beyond the control of the systems of this world, the rulers of this world, the whole shebang. So that means the classical Gnostics are dualists in that way. There are two gods. There's the god who created this world, and they equated him with the god of conventional religion. In other words, it's conventional religion that actually worships the false god, and so keeps us in the trap of just being identified with our bodies and with the, you know, the whole factory of humanity and life on Earth. But there is, and this is where Gnosis comes in, direct knowledge. We can know the god beyond that, and the whole world, you know, it's huge. When the world of matter and the world that we're in now is a tiny fragment of creation that's been somewhat divorced from the whole spiritual realm, we're in this duality, really, here, that we have two influences on us. There's this tiny spark of spiritual stuff within us that is mostly ignored, and so, you know, we're ignorant of it. We don't know it in the sense of Gnosis. And then we have the whole stuff that's going on in the world, the day-to-day stuff that keeps us asleep. And the Gnostics used, like many other teachings, the Sufis, the fourth way, use sleep and waking as metaphors for being aware of our spiritual lives or not. So we have a choice between two things. We have the spiritual world, or we have the world of matter. And the world that we're in is ruled by the demiurge. The whole entire realms and realms above it, which are connected to the true God. So in your original question, quantum physics is fascinating, but it suggests that the world isn't as we see it. The Newtonian physical universe that became so prominent in the 20th century, you know, this way of viewing things, rational way of viewing things just as being matter, is in fact being eroded by the ideas of quantum mechanics that far more have more in common with mystical thinking, spiritual thinking.
Is there consistently a some kind of ruler of darkness? I know they mentioned in the Gnostic Gospels the spirits of evil and the rulers of darkness. Would that be considered the aspect of the Demiurge?
Yes. The Demiurge and his archons.
Okay.
Now the archons. It comes from a Greek word. Meaning petty rulers, little rulers, you know, like governors.
Well, it sure seems like that's going on today.
Oh, yes. I mean, most modern Gnostics, you know, view these things as metaphors. I think, you know, if you really believe in demonic archons with the kind of names and functions that they had in the Nicandy Library, your only way to paranoia, at least in a modern context. This is another interesting aspect of the Gnostic viewpoint, is that I don't think they really differentiate between the internal world and the external world. I mean, the external world, of course, is matter, but internally, we also have, you know, externally we have this cosmology, we have God. God creates the Pleroma and all these eons. One of the eons falls, you get the Demiurge, matter is created, and that's the world we live in. But that also happens internally, and any advancement in Gnosticism occurs internally. So, when the human being is created, it's actually the archons create the different parts of the body. And in some Gnostic texts, like the Secret Book of John, there are long lists of these archons or demons who rule over the, the left leg, the right leg, the left calf, the right calf, the left testicle, the right testicle. Each part of the body has a demon that rules over it. But the soul was created by the Demiurge, not the spirit, which is the higher part, but the soul was created by the Demiurge.
Oh.
Now, the way I interpret this, and I think that the Gnostics interpreted it, is that that's like our ego.
Uh-huh.
Our ego is the equivalent of the Demiurge. And then the archons, who carry out the wishes of the Demiurge, they're equivalent to our little thoughts, you know, what in the fourth way tradition we call our eyes, the many eyes. Each little desire, each wandering thought that we have, it's carrying out the wishes of our false ego. So within us, we have the choice of being ruled by our own personal demiurge, this cruel, ignorant ruler who actually is completely ignorant of the whole spiritual realm above us, ego. Or we can try and make contact again with the true God, the spiritual realm above us, and the spark of spirit that every human being has been endowed with. For the Gnostics, there wasn't really psychology, it was cosmology. What happens within us is the same as what's happening in the world outside of us.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. And of course, the fourth way teachings speak about having to have a desire, first of all, a magnetic center, so to speak, a kind of a gravity towards spiritual ideas that become stronger in order to pull one out of materialism. And it seems today that mankind, or at least America in any case, is pretty immersed in materialism. It would take quite a shock to get us to wake up and move away from that, wouldn't it?
Yes. It's always difficult to tell what the situation is at the moment. I mean, there is an amazing amount of materialism, and you know, the most superficial kind, but also, you know, a spread of esoteric ideas and spiritual ideas that are much more prominent than they were 40 years ago in many ways.
Yeah.
And 30,
yeah.
40 years ago, there was a subculture of these things. But now, every bookshop, you know, these Barnes and Nobles and Borders, you know, all these, you know, the bookshops that are bookstores and the McDonald's are bookselling, basically.
Yeah,
but they,
yeah.
They have their special sections, and they have books about the kind of things that would have been copied by hand 1,500 years ago and would have been incredibly rare.
Yeah. And also, you know, I've noticed quite a bit of conversations and dialogues about a group that is behind a lot of the different orders called the Illuminati. Are you familiar with that?
I must say, I mean, I think the actual Illuminati were an 18th century group, weren't they?
I believe so. The Illumined ones.
Yeah, the historical Illuminati. I must say, I'm not very big on that, but I am interested in this sort of thread of esotericism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm filling in some gaps in my knowledge in the sort of 17th, 18th century, 19th century development of the Western esotericism there. The whole idea of the Illuminati, I mean, it's somewhat akin to the idea of an inner circle of humanity, or, the idea that there is, these aren't just unrelated movements that arise in human history, you know, separate little pools of culture that are irrelevant to anything else in human development. But there is something really, you know, real and spiritual behind it. While I might not be too convinced by the actual Illuminati, I do think that, you know, people who genuinely follow spiritual currents are connected with each other, and there is something behind it, you know. And then also there is this historical thread going from one movement to another that does get passed on. And with the Gnostics, that's actually quite interesting, because the Gnostics in the first, second, third centuries, and a little beyond that, they seem to have passed the torch on to the Manichaeans, who inherited Gnostic ideas.
Uh-huh.
And they trace themselves back to Mani from the third century, who was in Syria and then in Persia. And he founded a world religion, which, unlike the other world religions like Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, I suppose Judaism as well, has faded away. It was so strongly persecuted that there are only tiny little remnants of it remaining in the texts and the memories. But in its time, it was incredibly widespread, and went as far west as Spain. And as far east as China, there are Manichaeans in China. And they were a little bit different to the ancient Gnostics. They were absolute dualists. They proposed that there was light and there was dark. Light is the good part, the part side that you want to be on, but the darkness had eroded the light, and in fact, the world came into being as a result of the wars between the light and darkness.
Huh.
And the point of life on Earth is to liberate the light that is trapped in different beings. In humans, we can liberate it spiritually. It's like the same as the Gnostic idea that we have a spark of divinity within us. We have this light within us, and if we work on ourselves, we can liberate it. And then we can, when we die, pass beyond this world into the world of light. But they also thought that light was trapped in other beings, like vegetables even. And the Manichaeans were very careful not to trample grass down, because it would be disrespectful to the little fragments of light that were in the grass. But they also thought that there's more light in some vegetables, like melons and cucumbers, which you can understand the reasoning behind that. So they would eat those vegetables, those light vegetables, and then they would liberate the light from it. And there's a whole cosmic process of the light being liberated, which involved the moon, actually, which has another connection to Gurdjieff's ideas. The moon, these souls went to the moon where they were processed, but not in a negative way. It was just like a staging post on the way to their later existence in the realm of light. So the Manichaeans really deserve to be known. I mean, there are no more Manichaeans. Even though Mani, their founder, has actually survived as a Buddhist saint in parts of China. But they handed the baton on to the Paulicians, who were in the Near East in Turkey, who were also dualists. They upheld many of the same ideas. They passed on to the Bogomils, who were in the Balkans, and there's a Bulgaria, Yugoslavia area, to pass on to the Cathars, who are also very well known in spiritual circles. And the medieval Cathars were unfortunately slaughtered, by the Catholic Crusaders. But there's still a line of Gnosticism through the Mandeans, who were maybe go back to John the Baptist. They revere John the Baptist, not even as their founder figure, but as a Mandean saint. And actually, funnily enough, the Mandeans, Jesus was completely on the wrong track. They saw Jesus as an apostate, somebody who had gone along the wrong lines and was something of a heretic. But they genuinely go back to the first or second century, and they survived in Iran and Iraq until the present day.
Oh, that's interesting.
But they were alternately persecuted and respected by Muslims. Because Muslims respected anybody who were people of the book. And in the Quran, there are mentioned Sabians, who are these unknown people, who are mentioned along with Christians and Jews as people of the book who should be respected, Especially if they convert to Islam. But they have their own religions, genuine religions. So the Mandeans are identified as Sabians because they have their own sacred writings, and they survived, in small groups. Their baptism was very important to them, and they had this weekly baptismal ceremony, and they survived up to the present day. But the war in Iraq has had a very bad effect on them. I think that Saddam Hussein had a mixed effect on them. On the one hand, any minority group is being persecuted. But on the other hand, because they weren't Kurds, who in the region where they lived, there are lots of Kurds who were being persecuted by Saddam Hussein, and they were actually preferred over the Kurds. So they didn't do too badly under Saddam Hussein. But now with the war in Iraq, and all the, these ancient wounds are being reopened, and there's all this internal fighting, in addition to the Western presence there. There have been these wholesale slaughters of Mandeans, who were the last surviving historical Gnostics. And there's been a strong move to try and give Mandeans preferred status as refugees in the USA. And there are Mandean communities, or at least, a few hundred Mandeans in parts of USA, like New Jersey, and I think in the L.A. area,
I wanted to ask you before we, you know, reach the end of the of our time. You're also working on a biography of Rodney Collin, aren't you?
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
He's one of my favorite writers. I'll never forget the first time I read his book, The Theory of Celestial Influence. I was just blown away by it. It's kind of an attempt to bring science and esoteric teachings into harmony. Do you want to? Could you talk a little bit about Rodney Collin? He had quite an interesting life and an interesting death too, didn't he?
Oh yes, certainly. Yeah. Well, he studied with Uspensky.
Yeah.
And who, you know, is an esoteric writer himself and the people of Gurdjieff. And he, yes, Rodney Collin, there's lots of history to to relate here, but Uspensky, in the last year of his life, returned to England after having moved to America during the Second World War.
Uh-huh.
When he returned to England, he was very, very different. Uspensky had always been teaching these little groups of students about the system that he had inherited from Gurdjieff. And when he got to England, he said that he abandoned the system. And he lived a very quiet life in his last months in Lang Place on the outskirts of London, a country house there. And he and the many of Uspensky's students, they didn't know what to make of this abandonment of the system. You know, they wanted something to follow. But for others, it was like this kind of freedom. You know, a series of rules that you follow, or series of prescribed ideas that you have to agree with. I think that's what Uspensky was getting at there, you know. He created a bit of a Frankenstein monster, and although, you know, it has a very strong value in itself, it's something that does have to be abandoned, you know, if it becomes too dogmatic. Rodney Collin experienced this as the most profound time of his life, and he felt that Uspensky was demonstrating everything that he was at this time. So he had these profound spiritual experiences in these last months in Lyme Place in England, and at that time started writing The Theory of Celestial Influence as well, which is based on the cosmology from Gurdjieff and Uspensky of the Law of Three, the Law of Seven. And Rodney Collin found all these different examples of the action of three different notions and seven different aspects in science, in all the different branches of science, in physics, in chemistry, in the octaves of the periodical table. And then he expanded that into history, the idea of esoteric schools appearing periodically in history and in mankind as well, and the action of glands in man, and the types, the planetary types that occur in man, and the solar system. And then although it's not all that well known, just as Uspensky died, which is apparently a very strong experience for many of, not many, but the few of Uspensky's followers, had stayed with him to the end there, and they felt that he achieved enlightenment thoroughly in those last days. And locked himself away in Uspensky's bedroom for 3 or 5 or 7 days, depending on the account, which seems to be he felt was the time that he crystallized. You know, he'd been making all these efforts, spiritual efforts, during his time with Uspensky, and then it all came to a head at that time, and immediately after Uspensky's death, he seemed very much simpler and like a child.
Interesting. It makes you wonder, doesn't it, about less you become as a child.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, there's so much...
And then in that week after Uspensky's death, he conceived the whole scheme of his future work and the future projects that he used to be involved with. So the theory of celestial influence is this compendious volume that looks at all of the sciences and, you know, more or less the whole of human knowledge in terms of the cosmic laws that Gurdjieff had proposed. And also there's a theory of eternal life.
Oh, that's a wonderful book.
Yes, which is a brilliant synthesis of all the different ideas about what happens to us after death. You know, whether you go to hell, you go to heaven, you're in purgatory, whether you recur into the same life again and again, or you're reincarnated into a different life. He puts them all together and he ties them in with different ancient scriptures and spiritual texts, through the Tibetan Book of the Dead and Plato and everything. It's a brilliant synthesis of everything. And I think almost any view of life after death is contained in that book.
Well, you know, we'll have to do another show and talk more about Gurdjieff and Uspensky and Colin, and find out, you know, more about these ideas. I think that would be a great show to have, don't you?
Yeah, sure. I think the book on Robbie Colin will be out by the end of the year. So.
Oh, wonderful! I can't wait. Would you tell the listeners how they can get in contact with your website or and get your books?
Yes, sure. My website is Bardic Press, BARDIC-PRESS.com. So I also publish and reprint other books in the Gurdjieff Uspensky tradition, Sufis and the Gnostics. I'm the author of Gnostic Writings on the Soul, The Lost Sayings of Jesus, and The Gospel of Philip, Annotated and Explained. I have a book which is a thorough introduction to the Gnostics coming out in the fall from Watkins. I'm also just finishing a dictionary of the Gnostics, because the Gnostic Writings are full of weird terminology and bizarre things. I'm just finishing that this month, and that should be out in the spring by Quest, the philosophical publisher.
Wonderful. Well, I thank you very much, Andrew, for spending time with us and shedding some light on things that, we all are interested in. So I thank you for being here, and I look forward to our chat on Gurdjieff and Uspensky in the Fourth Way and Colin. And I wish you the very best.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
And thank you, listeners. And I appreciate your listening. And that is a wrap. We will say goodnight.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.